Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming to this next episode in the Paul Olson Lecture Series, which we're very proud of here at the Center for Great Plains Studies. This spring, we have chosen the Olson Lecturers, people whose research focuses on topics that are related to or affiliated in some way with our spring symposium, which is coming up March 28 to 30. If you missed any of the posters that were in your way on the way in, I hope you check on the way out anyway. The symposium this year is called 1862 to 2012, The Making of the Great Plains. And it really is the sesquicentennial of four important pieces of legislation: the Homestead Act, the Morrill Act, the Pacific Railroad Act, and the act that established the USDA. As well, of course, 1862 was the year of the U.S.-Dakota War. So all of those things are topics of the symposium, which will be coming up. And everybody is invited to that symposium. There is a small registration fee, but you're all invited to come. On March 14, Professor Dennis Smith, historian at UNO, will be speaking in this lecture, this Olson Lecture Series, on the topic 19th Century Fort Peck Assiniboine Cultural Persistence. And on April 11, just after the symposium, Professor Ed Harvey here at UNL will be speaking on Reflections on the Morrill Act and the Man for Whom It's Named. Today, we have as our Olson lecturer our UNO colleague, Hugh Riley. Professor Riley is associate professor in the School of Communication at UNO. Before he came to the UNO faculty, he had an extensive career in advertising, marketing, and public relations. He has written or co-written 6 books on a variety of topics. The one that caught our attention for this particular part of our series is called Bound to Have Blood, Frontier Newspapers, and the Plains Indian Wars, published by the University of Nebraska Press, and for sale outside in the lobby if you're interested in purchasing a copy. Now, we're not the only one who thought this was a pretty interesting thing that Professor Riley had going. You may have seen today's World Herald. And if you did, you checked the editorials. And on the editorial page is something called History of the Plains. This editorial right here, it's a very generous and good, admiring review of Professor Riley's book. So we can't arrange for such editorials for every speaker that we have, but we did today. So I see, okay, all right. So I'm delighted to welcome you here today. Professor Riley's talk today is called The Great Sioux Uprising, 1862. Welcome.
Welcome, and really impressed with the turnout that you've got. Just a little bit of my background that kind of led me to some of this. I've worked for a couple of newspapers. I worked for the Omaha World Herald back when I was still in college, my first job in college. And I also worked for the Greeley, Colorado Tribune, or as we called it, the Gnarly Trombone. And so I always had a fascination with newspapers. And from the time that I was able to read, I had a fascination with Native American history and culture. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and I used to go to the little Benson Branch Library and read every book I could find on Native Americans. So when it came time for me to do my thesis, when I was working on my master's, it was a natural for me to combine the newspaper background that I had with my fascination with Native American history and culture. And so that's what I did. I did a thesis based on how the frontier newspapers covered 7 Indian wars and some other events. And that led to, eventually, to this book. This chapter that I'm going to talk about now actually wasn't in the original thesis, so this is something I added. I added a couple of other chapters to the book after I'd written the thesis. But I wanted to set the scene a little bit for you. And 1862, if you go back, December 26, 1862, it's the day after Christmas. Civil War is raging. Abraham Lincoln has just celebrated his second Christmas in office. And in Mankato, Minnesota, 36, 38 men are dangling from the gallows, where they hoped to hang 300. And they would have hanged 300 if it had not been for the intervention of Abraham Lincoln. So I want to tell you that story, how that happened, what led up to it, and it's all about the different thing that I do with this is that I'm using direct quotes from the newspapers, the Mankato newspaper and the couple of the St. Paul, Minnesota newspapers, New Ulm newspapers. My idea when I was writing this was to show you how the people of the time and place were writing about Native American issues, because a lot of times what we have retained when we see books about media coverage of Native American events, it's from the perspective of people from New York and Chicago and these big Eastern newspapers. And they were far removed from the action. They had a whole different perspective. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to go to these small town newspapers, where things close to where the things had happened, and see what they were writing about and how they felt about things. So here we go. The Sioux, you had the Dakota, which were the Eastern Sioux, and the Lakota, which were the Western Sioux, was the main separation in the two groups of the Sioux Nation or Dakota Nation. And in 1862, North Dakota, which was the Eastern Sioux, were confined to this reservation along the Minnesota River. Let's see if I get the... which was 10 miles wide and 150 miles long. They were traditionally hunters and gatherers. They were not agriculture. So they were kind of like a fish out of water in a sense. They're this very narrow land, very narrow reservation, and they were trying to survive on it. Well, they weren't able to survive on their own. They had to have annuities and things like that, which they were entitled to, according to treaty. They're dependent on the annuities, which was an annual fee that they got every year from the government, as well as food to survive. Well, in 1862, as you can imagine, there was a few other things that were consuming the government's money and time. There was a little thing called the Civil War that was raging back east. So as a result, a lot of the Native Americans' needs were neglected. Most of the money is being funneled to the war. They were supposed to get the annuities, the money and the food was supposed to arrive at the same time, which was in June of 1862. Well, the food arrived in June, and they stored it in these warehouses. But the money did not arrive because they weren't able to get Congress to get it for them. And so the food just remained in the warehouses. Meantime, the Sioux, who are depending on this food and depending on the annuities, are starving. Their people are dying. The food was rotting in the warehouses. 2 months go by. It's August. And they will not release the food until they get the annuities. And Little Crow, who's one of the leaders, saying, you know, he warned the whites that when men are starving, they help themselves. Finally, Andrew Myrick, I want to tell you this is kind of a little side thing. Andrew Myrick, who was a local trader and traded with the Sioux, when he heard the complaints from the Sioux, was reported to have said, if they're hungry, let them eat grass. Well, the annuity payments finally arrived on August 16th of 1862. Unfortunately, it was too late already, because the day after they arrived, there was a raid on a farmhouse, and just give you some details on what happened there. The goods were delivered to Fort Ridgely in August 17th of 1862. Unfortunately, that very same day, there was four young Dakota warriors, Killing Ghost, Breaking Up, Runs Against Something When Crawling, and Brown Wing, and they attacked a farm near Acton, Minnesota. And basically, it was a simple thing. They had an argument about stealing eggs. They were starving. So they were going to steal eggs from this farm. And there was an argument about stealing the eggs, and one of the men, the four Native Americans, was challenged, his courage was challenged. You know, they were just going to steal the eggs and leave them. One of the other guys said, you know, if you're so tough, you know, kill that white man. And he did. And he also killed his son-in-law, two women, and a girl of 14. So this things just got out of hand very quickly, and they ran back to their camp where Little Crow and some of the other chiefs were and told them what they had done. Little Crow, who was an experienced leader, tried to warn them of the trouble that was coming, and despite all these things that were going on, he knew that it was unlikely that they would be successful if they went to war against the whites. But some of the others said, most of the white men are preoccupied. They're fighting this war back east right now. They don't care about us. Most of the soldiers have gone back east. They're fighting there. A lot of the Minnesota frontiersmen have left. They're fighting the Union Army. This is a great opportunity. Not only would we not have to apologize for what's been done, but we could maybe reclaim some of our land, and we could right some of the grievances that we have. They also saw it as an opportunity. There had been several murders by local whites of some of the Native Americans, which had gone unpunished. And so they also saw that. They saw it as an opportunity for revenge for the murders and prosecution. Well, as I said, it didn't take long for them to react. They attacked the Redwood Agency, which was the agency that was closest to the reservation. And there was 20 people killed and 10 captured. Andrew Myrick was one of the first killed, the traitor, who said, "Let them eat grass." He tried to escape by crawling through the window, and they found his body slumped over the window with grass stuffed in his mouth. However, 47 escaped to nearby Fort Ridgely. One of the first newspapers to cover this was the Mankato Semi-Weekly Record, and they wrote about this uprising, kind of gives you an idea in terms of the accuracy of the newspapers. They said, "We have sufficient information to justify the belief that most all of the white persons at the two agencies, including traders, have been murdered, stores and buildings burned, and the goods all carried off or destroyed. At the upper agency, there were about 25 white persons, all of whom were believed to have been killed. The brave little band fought the Indians for 2.5 days. When most of the men having been killed, the remainder were forced to surrender. No quarters were shown them, but all were butchered in the most brutal manner." Well, that was baloney. Contrary to what the newspaper wrote, as I said, 47 people escaped. The siege did not last 2 days. It was over in a matter of hours. And they went to nearby Fort Ridgely. And the commander of Fort Ridgely was a guy by the name of John S. March, and he set off with 46 soldiers to set things right. It wasn't a good idea. He was outnumbered. He was outnumbered, and he was ambushed, and about 20 of his soldiers were killed, and the rest fled back to Fort Ridgely. Well, now a panic started to set in, and the newspapers, the Mankato newspapers, the St. Paul newspapers, were writing about all these things that were happening. But the Semi-Weekly Record tried to put the Indian War in perspective. Now, they were in Mankato, so they're somewhat removed from the action, but not too far away. But they wrote that all kinds of false and silly rumors have been circulated down the river in regard to the Indian depredations. One to the effect that Mankato was in ashes and St. Peter would be in a few hours. Another that the people of this and adjoining counties had all been butchered and that the whole country was a complete waste. Of course, nothing could be more absurd. We question whether a Sioux Indian has been within our county since the difficulty commenced, and we are sure if there is an instance of this kind, no white person knew of it. So, while they had done some inaccurate reporting initially about what had happened at the agency, they were trying to tamp down some of the panic. They also mocked some of the fears of their readers when they wrote about a rumor that was going around among the area's Indian tribes. They wrote, "A Sioux Indian predicted to a Winnebago a few days ago that his tribe would plant corn next year where the towns of Mankato and St. Peter now are. We rather think this prediction will not be fulfilled, but a more likely one is that the Sioux reservation will be converted into a Sioux burying ground." Actually, as it turned out, that was a pretty accurate prediction. Well, the next thing that the Sioux did was they attacked the next town in line, which was the town of New Ulm, which, if you've been to Minnesota, it's a fairly prosperous town now. They approached the town from the west and quickly surrounded it. And according to the Mankato Record, they commenced their attack by firing a number of buildings on the outskirts. Some of the attacking party were on horseback and others on foot. Their approach was characterized with caution and system as they closed in on the town. And New Ulm was not that far from Mankato, so the people in Mankato were beginning to panic and thinking, if New Ulm is under attack, we're next. So a lot of people were packing up their wagons and leaving town and heading even further east. There was reports that the New Ulm garrison was surrounded by flames and hundreds of Indians were surrounding it. There was rumors of a combined attack by the Sioux and the Winnebago forces. Throughout this whole Dakota War, Sioux War, there was talks about the Winnebago participation, but except for a few individual Winnebagos, there really was no participation from the Winnebagos. They tried to remain neutral. In the end, it didn't help them, as I'll relate to you later on in this talk. But the newspaper talked about wanting revenge for what was happening in New Ulm. And some of the language that they used, I think, is interesting. They describe these attacks on the settlers in New Ulm as being similar to what had happened in Ohio and Kentucky settlers a century before. They described it as the savage war whoop, their insatiable thirst for murder and barbarity, scarcely finds a parallel in American history. In every instance where a hand-to-hand conflict occurred, our men repulsed the red devils with that cool determination that characterizes brave men. On Sunday morning after consultation, Judge Flandreau ordered such buildings as could not be safely held to be destroyed, and the whole of the population, consisting of about 2,000 men, women, and children, were concentrated in about two squares in order to more successfully be defended. It goes on to describe some more of the fighting, and it says, after about an hour fighting, the savages withdrew, driving off such stock as they could conveniently take with them. Well, those citizens that had survived the Battle of New Ulm packed up what they could and headed east towards safety. And according to the record, the Mankato record, in the absence of the town citizens, many of New Ulm's homes were looted by their fellow settlers passing through on their way to safety. So it wasn't even the Native Americans who looted the homes, it was the other farmers and ranches in the area who were fleeing east and said, well, yeah, here's an opportunity. In an article entitled The Remedy, the record wrote that it was a quote-unquote settled fact that the southwest portion of the state would lose a large percentage of its population due to the recent massacre. It stated that the state's citizens could not be expected to settle in a place where peace and safety could not be guaranteed. It will be folly to attempt to restore public confidence so long as there is a hostile Indian within our state limits, and not until they are totally exterminated or driven beyond our boundary and our frontier guarded by a line of forts, a sure barrier to further depredation, will peace and prosperity again smile upon us. There's some of the citizens of New Ulm on their way to safety further east. A relief force actually came out from Mankato and helped to evacuate them and took them back to Mankato and even further east. As I said, the absence of the town citizens, many of New Ulm's homes were looted by their fellow settlers passing through on their way to safety. There's photos of a couple of the main combatants here. You have Colonel Henry H. Sibley, who was leading the forces, the Army forces, as well as Minnesota Volunteers, and Little Crow, who was one of the principal chiefs of the Dakota. So there was, as you can imagine, there was a lot of cries for revenge because of the massacre. The Mankato record actually talked about how this was going to, they were so dependent upon immigrants from Europe to populate Minnesota, this was going to have a negative effect on immigration. And they wrote that the cruelties perpetrated by the Sioux Nation in the last 2 weeks demand that our government shall treat them for all time as outlaws who have forfeited all rights to property and life. They must cease to be the wards of government and their whole possessions and annuities converted into funds to recuperate so far as money will do so for the depredations already committed. Nothing short of this policy will appease our people. We want no more treaties or compromises. Minnesota must be either a Christian land or a savage hunting ground. Either the white man must exercise undisputed sway or the Indian. The two races can never live peacefully and prosperously together again. Give you another perspective, there was a woman named Jane Gray Swisshelm who was a kind of a fascinating woman, and she was a editor of the St. Cloud Democrat, and she was a feminist and was very progressive in a lot of ways, but she also agreed with the sentiments of the record and that no quarter should be given to the Dakota. And she wrote in her paper, "Let our present legislator offer a bounty of $10 for every Sioux scalp, outlaw the tribe and so let the matter rest. It will cost 5 times that much to exterminate them by their regular modes of warfare, and they should be got rid of in the cheapest and quickest manner." Well, as you can imagine, due to the differences in population, due to better trained forces, due to better arms, the end was pretty inevitable. There was some initial success on the part of the Dakota, but eventually things went bad. They had some successes at the Battle of Birch Coulee, where they ambushed some soldiers, but they were forced to withdraw upon the arrival of Colonel Sibley's forces. And Sibley had artillery, he had cavalry, and basically there was a final battle. General Pope, with his forces, was coming around from another direction, and they had large armies of thousands of men in the field, against which the Sioux probably had hundreds. Sibley and Pope surround Little Crow and his forces and demand that he release prisoners and surrender. There were a lot of prisoners that were actually captured during this battle, and they were going to be held for ransom. In fact, there's a gentleman in the crowd who came up and spoke to me. Reuben, where's Reuben? Right there, who has some ancestors who were actually captured during the Sioux uprising. So I look forward to talking with him more about that afterwards. The final battle, the Indians kind of risked it all on a last throw of dice, and they attacked Sibley's camp, and they had no answer for the artillery, and they were repulsed and were defeated. Well, Little Crow and some of his followers, some of the Dakota fled east into what we now know as Dakota, what was then Dakota Territory, which we now know as South Dakota and North Dakota. Little Crow and some of his men went north into Canada, but most of the tribe stayed where they were and basically put themselves at the mercy of Sibley and his forces and hoped for the best. Now they started counting the cost of the war, and there were some inaccuracies there as well. The record, the Mankato record, again reported that the military authorities in Brown County buried 343 victims of last August's massacres. In the township of Milford, only 4 out of 44 total citizens survived. Major Brandt estimates that the Indians have killed 900 people since the trouble began. Well, a more accurate death count would probably be around 500, which is still terrible, horrific. According to historical records, I mean, the war basically lasted for 37 days. And 77 American soldiers, 29 citizen soldiers, and approximately 358 settlers were killed. And they don't really have any kind of account in terms of the names of Dakota that were killed. Well, not surprisingly, the newspapers at the time were very political. One paper would be for the Democrats, the other paper would be for the Republicans. And so they used this whole way to further their political aims. And the party out of power was going to blame the party that was in power for this whole problem. The record, in an editorial entitled "Where the Responsibility Lies," chastised the Dakota, but they also pointed the finger at the government. And they said, "We do not pretend to apologize in the slightest for the atrocities so lately perpetrated by the Sioux upon our defenseless frontier settlers, but demand in retaliation, therefore, their total extermination. Yet we sincerely believe that when the whole matter has been thoroughly and fairly investigated, the main cause of the outbreak will be the fraudulent conduct of the Indian officials. The Indian ideas of justice are such that he does not discriminate between the men committing the wrongs and innocent persons, and in seeking revenge has made an indiscriminate war on the whole white race." And they criticized the government not paying the annuities on time, not getting the food out on time, and a variety of other criticisms. They followed up their editorial with another one by saying, 1,000 lives have been sacrificed by this band of thieves. And they're referring to the government and the traders, the people that supplied the annuities and that sort of thing. In the accomplishment of their hellish purposes, and the blood of our frontier settlers is now being used to corrupt and control our elections and maintain the supremacy of the heartless and guilty wretches. One of the great things when I was doing the research on this is just the colorful language that they use. Unfortunately, we don't have this kind of language in our media anymore. And it's fun to read it and to while we would consider it kind of over the top, it certainly is very interesting to read, and they don't pull any punches. They relate directly to an upcoming election, because this was in November. It says, on Tuesday next, every voter will be called upon to render his verdict, and we appeal to each and all by the thousands of lives already sacrificed, by our depopulated and desolated frontier, by the thousands of women and children driven from their homes, penniless and dependent on public charity, to consider well the responsibility. The opportunity will never again return, and we beseech the voters of our state to lay aside all party feeling and cast their votes for men who will remove every Indian from our borders and dedicate the rich and virgin soil of Minnesota to civilization and Christianity. Now, not everybody was for extermination. There were some voices crying out in the wilderness, and one of them was a Reverend W.S. Williamson, who claimed he had made inquiries into the alleged Dakota cruelties, but could find no evidence of anything beyond acts of war. But the record and said they had a number of instances that have occurred where females have been brutally ravished after death. We have it upon good authority that two children were found in Brown County with their feet tied together and strung across a fence. Also, one instance where a body was found nailed to a wall. In the face of such facts, we fear the doctor will not make much headway in manufacturing sympathy for the Indian wards. The as I mentioned earlier, the Winnebagoes, who had very little to do with this, except for a few individuals, were being, there was an opportunity. The Winnebagoes were a prosperous tribe and then had some very desirable land, and so some of their neighbors saw a way to move them off their land and make their land available as well. And so they started to accused the Winnebago as being hand-in-hand with the Dakota, with the Sioux, even though there was really no evidence that that had happened. The Mankato Record laid out its case by saying, it is the general and firm belief of our people that a portion of the Winnebago tribe has been and even now is engaged with the Sioux in murdering and plundering white settlers. This belief is founded principally upon circumstantial evidence, but is sufficiently strong to justify the most positive conviction on the part of those best acquainted with the Indians. As I said, Little Wolf and some of his followers fled north and some went to the west. The ones that went to west were actually pursued by Sibley and his forces, and in a series of battles in Dakota territory, they were defeated. And we'll get back to Little Crow. He re-enters the picture later on in the story. As I mentioned, it was used as a political weapon. The Indians were accused of barbarism. The story I read to you about the people being nailed to a tree and things like that, there was lots of stories like that in the papers. Tried to include the Winnebago as villains. And in the end, they decided to select 400 Dakota and put them on trial for murder. They didn't consider this to have been a war. This was murder. So we're going to find these 400 Dakota, put them on trial for murder, rape, and other crimes. And they were really selected for pretty questionable reasons. Somebody had a grudge against somebody. Somebody thought they saw something. Somebody didn't like somebody. So there was a lot of this personal thing that was going on. And General John Pope, he basically thought, okay, select 400 of them, we'll execute them, and that'll be the end of it. Most of these people who were selected were simply scapegoats. Some had been involved on a very, slight way, and others had not been involved at all, hadn't been anywhere near the action. But they'd been identified, and they were gathered up, captured, and they were taken to Mankato for trial. And even moving these prisoners from New Ulm and places actually west of New Ulm, they had to go through New Ulm to get them there, and there's a little lithograph of as they rode through the streets of New Ulm, these citizens came out and threw stones and bricks and whatever they could find at the Indians as the army escorted them through the town. In the end, 392 Indians were tried, 42 in a single day. You can imagine how long those court cases must have been if there was 42. And a day. Pretty perfunctory, you know. Okay, come on in. So-and-so, so-and-so. Okay, fine. You're guilty. So, of the 392 that were tried, 303 were sentenced to be hanged. 20 were sentenced to terms of imprisonment, and the remainder were released. The newspaper was the record in this case. Again, the Mankato Record was very solicitous of the prisoners. They kind of poked fun, but again, it's undescriptive of how the Native Americans were viewed by the press at the time. The newspaper described them as, "One day all the elderly men, who were in their vigor of their manly strength, and their hair was too gray to go into battle, and the young men, age 18 to 25, insisted that they were too young and their hearts were too weak to face fire. Another frozen-faced, shaggy-haired, rank specimen of many winters looked more like the devil than anything human. I should have run from him in fright had he been a, quote-unquote, good Indian in times of peace. It is a reasonable probability that he was satanic. Horns and tail were all that were necessary to make the personification." Well, President Lincoln wasn't so sure that taking these 300 Indians and executing them was the right thing to do. So he sent a telegram to General Pope saying, "I require evidence, proof that evidence of guilt and proof before he could execute any of the prisoners." So Pope gathered what he could, and he sent it to Lincoln. And the record, again, Lincoln claimed what he was looking for was he only wanted to punish the ringleaders. He didn't want to punish some of these other people who had kind of been around for long for the ride or maybe not participated at all. And the newspaper mocked Lincoln's description of ringleaders. And they said that the massacre was premeditated and simultaneous by the whole Sioux tribe. And it must indeed be a nice discrimination that can distinguish the quote-unquote ringleaders from the followers. All alike are murderers, and no punishment short of hanging will satisfy the citizens of Minnesota. If the government will not execute them, the people must, and woe to the men or set of men who interpose between the people and the savage murderers. In its fervor to punish the Indians, the record was endorsing not only mob rule, but treason. I found it interesting. You see sometimes in these old newspapers, you'll see them use poetry, which you don't see very often in newspapers today. But one of the most popular poems of the day was a poem called The Charge of the Light Brigade, which Alfred Lord Tennyson, which many of you may be familiar with. Well, in the one of the Minnesota newspapers, I believe it was the St. Paul Pioneer Express, came up with a poem that they called Charge of the Hemp Brigade, hemp being the material that they used to make the ropes. And I want to read this to you because I think it's a chilling insight into the mindset. "Hemp on the throat of them, hemp round the neck of them, hemp under the ears of them, twisting and choking, stormed at with shout and yell, grandly they'll hang and well, until the jaws of death, until the mouth of hell takes the 300. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to hang and die, into the valley of death, send the 300. Hemp on the throat of them, hemp round the neck of them, hemp under the chin of them, twisting and choking, stormed at with shout and yell, where wives and children fell. They that have killed so well, come to the jaws of death, come to the mouth of hell. All that is left of them, left of 300. When can their memory fade? All the sad deaths they made, all the state mourned, weep for the deaths they made, but give to the hemp brigade the devilish 300. Well, the people of Minnesota were concerned that Lincoln was going to pardon all or even some of the Indians, and so they threatened to, the St. Paul Pioneer wrote that secret societies are being formed throughout the state, the avowed object of which is to hang or to shoot every Indian suspected of having a hand in the Indian massacre should the government refuse to execute them. No less than 500 men of St. Paul have signed a pledge for that purpose. It's a lithograph of the Indians being held for trial and awaiting their sentencing. In the end, Lincoln committed the sentences of all of them except for 38. And the response from Minnesota was immediate and harsh. In a letter to the editor, from the Mankato Record, a group calling itself, and I find this kind of interesting, the Sioux Exterminators Lodge, number 28. Why number 28? I don't know, but it was number 28. promised a certain fate for the Dakota, no matter what President Lincoln decided. They wrote, "Rumor, double-tongued, brings us to much too frequently words of doubt as to the fate of the red devils who have desolated our frontier. Shall we hold meetings and petition the President that justice be meted them? Nay, let me tell you that I violate no secret when I say to you that all the Quakers this side of eternity cannot save a single red devil. If President Lincoln will not heed the petition that goes to him from 500 murdered whites, he will pay but little attention to the schoolboy resolutions of the living. So we of the frontier watch and wait. No matter the how or when, but sure as there is a living God, there will be a carnival of death somewhere among the Indians, even if from Washington comes orders to let the miscreants loose." Well, as I said, Lincoln finally decided. The actually initial report was that Lincoln had decided to hang 30 rather than 38, which was inaccurate. But the detail was interesting. They said, well, first we're going to hang, he's going to hang 10 and see how that goes. And if it goes well, he'll hang another 10. If that seems to be enough, he'll stop there. Otherwise, he'll hang the third 10. Well, yeah, that was ridiculous. He had actually looked at the evidence that he could find and had decided to hang 38. Actually, initially 39, but at the last minute, one was reprieved, and I'm not sure why or what happened there. The Minnesota congressional delegation, there was a Minnesota senator, Morton S. Wilkinson, and a congressman, Cyrus Aldrich, and William Windom, who wrote a letter of protest to Lincoln about the fact that he was commuting most of these sentences. They wrote, "There was no war about it. It was wholesale robbery, rape, murder. The people of Minnesota have been patient and stood by you and have not taken the law into their own hands because they believed the president would deal with them justly. We protest against the pardon of those Indians because if it is done, the Indians will become more insolent and criminal than they ever were before. They will believe that the Great Father in Washington justifies their act or is afraid to punish them for their crimes. We protest against it because if the president does not permit these executions to take place under the forms of law, the enraged people of Minnesota will dispose of these wretches without law. We do not wish to see the mob law inaugurated in Minnesota, as it certainly will be if you force the people to it." So this was the senator and the two congressmen from Minnesota writing this letter. I'd mentioned the fact that some of these people were probably most likely scapegoats, and I wanted to read you just a little excerpt from one of them, a man by the name of, I can't pronounce his Dakota name, so I'm going to use his white name. They called him Rattling Runner. And he wrote to his father-in-law, Wabasha. They're not really sure, doesn't really say in my research as to why he was selected, but he was selected for some reason. He didn't partake in any of the battles. He wasn't even remotely near the action, but somebody didn't like him. So he had talked to his father-in-law, and his father-in-law said, well, just, you know, submit to trial. I'm sure there's no evidence. They'll find you innocent, and you'll go free. But unfortunately, for Rattling Runner, he was found guilty. So he writes to his father-in-law, "You told me that the advice of General Sibley and gave ourselves up to the whites, all would be well. No innocent man would be injured. I have not killed, wounded, or injured any white man or any white persons. I have not participated in the plunder of their property, and yet today I am set apart for execution and must die in a few days, while men who are guilty will remain in prison. My wife is your daughter, my children, your grandchildren. I leave them all in your care and under your protection. Do not let them suffer. And when my children grow up, let them know that their father died because he followed the advice of his chief and without having the blood of a white man to answer for, to the Great Spirit." One of the things that did happen was an armed mob was formed in New Ulm and started marching to the camp where the prisoners were being held. And their intent was to kill all the ones that were not going to be executed. But they were intercepted somewhere along the way by the army and turned back. So that at least didn't happen. The execution itself, while it was not 300 men, it was 38, it was still the largest and remains the largest execution in the history of the United States. 38 men were executed simultaneously, put them up on a big scaffold and pulled the ropes. The St. Paul Pioneer Press had a reporter there, and this was one of the most chilling pieces in the research that I did, but it's very descriptive, and I think it's very insightful. He was there the morning of the hanging as they were preparing the Dakota to be taken out to be hung. And he gives us a kind of a vivid view of what their last minutes were like. There was a huge crowd witnessing this hanging, and they'd come from miles and miles around. I mean, it was a fair day. They had little booths. They were selling things. It was a festival mood permeating the crowd. They'd come to see. This was a huge, huge event. There's a picture of it from Harper's Weekly. You see the crowd of soldiers around there. They've got the scaffolding. There's people all around forming crowds watching this event. Describing what happened here, the reporter for the Pioneer Press writes, "While Father Revue was speaking to them, old Tazu broke out in a death wail, in which one after another joined, until the prison room was filled with an unearthly plaint, which was neither of despair nor grief, but rather a paroxysm of savage passion. Most impressive to witness and startling to hear, even for those who understood the language of the music only. During the lulls in their death song, they would resume their pipes, and with the exception of occasional mutter or rattling of their chains, they sat motionless and impassive, until one among the older would break out into the wild wail, and then all would join again in solemn preparation for death." So they were all chained, foot to foot and hand to hand. According to the Pioneer, the death song relaxed them, and they all seemed resigned and unconcerned as they shuffled, loosely shackled hand and feet, out of the prison room toward the scaffold. White caps were placed over their heads and pulled over their faces. And the reporter says then, "There then ensued a scene that can hardly be described and which can never be forgotten. All joined in shouting and singing, as it appeared to those who were ignorant of the language. The tunes seemed somewhat discordant, and yet there was harmony in it. Save the moment of cutting the rope, it was the most thrilling moment of the awful scene. And it was not their voices alone. Their bodies swayed to and fro, and their every limb seemed to be keeping time. The drop trembled and shook as all were dancing. The most touching scene on the drop was their attempt to grasp each other's hands, fettered as they were. They were very close to each other, and many succeeded. Three or four in a row were hand in hand, and all hands swaying up and down with the rise and fall of their voices." Well, the words that they were chanting were not some defiant death song that people who didn't know the language thought it was. What was happening by people who understood Dakota was that each man was shouting his own name and calling out the names of his friends, saying, "I am here, I am here." Well, as I mentioned to you, some of the Dakota had fled north, but the most of them stayed there. And they were 1,300 to 1,700 surviving Dakota were confined to a military prison, and many of them died of starvation during the winter. There's a shot of the camp there. All of the Dakota and all of the Winnebago were removed from Minnesota. Most of them ended up in Nebraska. The Santee Sioux is what's left of the eastern Dakota, the Santee Sioux Reservation, up in the northeast corner of Nebraska. And, of course, the Winnebago, even though they had very little to do with the war, were also removed, and they are in the Winnebago Reservation in northeast Nebraska. 130 Dakota died in the camp or on their trek to their new home in Nebraska, northeast Nebraska, not northwest, excuse me. And Little Crow. There was a bounty on Sioux scalps, of $25 a head. Well, Little Crow had fled to Canada, but in the summer of 1863, so several months later, he drifted back to Minnesota. Probably wasn't the smartest thing for him to do, but that's where, you know, that's where he grew up, that's where he lived, so he drifted back to Minnesota. And on July 3rd, he was killed by a farmer near Hutchinson, Minnesota. He and his son were picking raspberries, and the farmer saw them, and knowing there was a $25 bounty on Sioux scalps for fugitive Dakota, he shot him and killed him. When it was discovered that the Indian he'd killed was Little Crow, he was paid a $500 bonus. Little Crow's body was, of course, it's July 3rd, so the next day being July 4th, they took Little Crow's body and they dragged it through the streets of Hutchinson. And the children celebrated the 4th of July by placing firecrackers in his ears and his nose. His body was dismembered and his skull and scalp were sent to St. Paul, where they remained until 1971. The only monument that I've seen is this little one that's in downtown Mankato, and it's kind of under a bridge. You have to really kind of search for it. But that's about all that's left. That and a few place names. and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.